ready to keep you company wherever you are. Carte Blanche, the podcast, brings you immersive, hard-hitting stories anytime, anywhere, every week.
Turn up the volume and get ready for another jam-packed episode of The Whole Week Wrap with Daily Maverick and Carte Blanche. Joining us this week is Daily Maverick journalist Michelle Bunder. Here's what's coming your way. As the inquiry into the deadly Usindiso building fire wraps up, survivors are running out of time. Another step closer to Eskom 2.0, but will it solve our power problems? Then several arrests in the Fort Hare University scandal exposes a deadly network of crime and corruption.
It's really getting out of hand. It might even translate to other universities. Maybe there are things happening there that no one really knows about at the moment.
And bye-bye e-tolls. Government says, we promise. But first, National Speaker Nosiviwe Mapisa Ngakula made her first court appearance last week, facing 12 counts of corruption and one of money laundering. Then, StatsSA's long-awaited migration report shows that the so-called brain regain is mere wishful thinking. Let's get into it. Welcome back to the show, Michelle. It's always lovely to have you with us. How are you doing?
I'm well, thank you. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. It's always lovely to chat to you. So yeah, and you haven't been with us for a while, so it's good to hear your voice again.
Thank you.
So of course, we cannot start today's show without first addressing the big development around the national speaker. In last week's episode, Ray Mahlaka and I chatted about Nosiviwe Mapisa Ngakula's imminent arrest and the difficult decision to be made by the ANC. Well, last week, the ruling party made it very clear that we cannot risk standing by our national speaker. Were you surprised by her resignation and then, of course, the subsequent arrest?
I was not really surprised. To an extent, I expected it to happen.
I did a double take when I first read the ANC statement, because the ANC is known for not really following through on doing the right thing necessarily. Mm-hmm. But it also makes complete sense, really, because there's just too much on the line in an election year for them to stand by her. So I think the resignation was probably the best way out of a really, really tricky situation. And yeah, now we see what happens in court. Of course, she has said that she doesn't expect to serve any time, which is quite a big statement. But let's see what happens and what comes from the court proceedings. But let's get into today's show. Now, there's been a lot of talk lately around the so-called brain regain. Of course, that's the concept of expats returning to South Africa and feeding back into the economy. But StatsSA's first migration report since 2000 paints a very different picture. And it turns out the allure of biltong and braais is simply not enough to bring people back.
Certainly, I would agree with the fact that I don't think a lot of people are actually returning to South Africa. Instead, a lot of people, having traveled myself in the last 2 months, I've seen that a lot of people are actually moving out of South Africa for greener pastures. They're not coming back from countries such as the UK, Australia, and others, where they see that the economy is much better. We have a lot of issues, you know, the corruption, load shedding, the water shedding. There's a lot happening. There's no jobs. I would ask myself, why do you think people are coming back home when the country's in a state?
Exactly. And for me, the big takeaway, as you've just said, is that there has been a sharp decline in the number of people returning to South Africa. In 2011, it was around 45,000 people opting to give South Africa a second chance. But when you look at the figures for 2022, it's dropped to just below 28,000, which is quite concerning. And of course, the report also speaks to how migrants play a big contributing role in terms of a country's economy and the labor force. So overall, it's a big loss for South Africa. But my question now is, how do you attract expats when there's so much wrong in our country? I mean, you've just made the long list. How do you attract people to come back to the country?
That's the big question. Will these elections make things much better? Maybe things will have like a turnaround and maybe it will loop people back into the country. But I don't think people are coming back home. People are actually leaving. Even myself, I was there. I was like, you know, I can survive abroad, but I still love home.
I mean, I have family members who moved to Australia and to the US, and even they are saying, regardless of the outcome of the elections, they have no plan on coming back. They are very happy where they are. They've applied for their full residency. They're making it home. So, yeah, we're not going to see them moving back anytime soon. So I agree with you. I don't think there's enough yet in South Africa to attract people back.
On the 31st of August, a hijacked building in Marshalltown, Johannesburg, went up in flames. Ultimately, 76 people were killed and hundreds left homeless. 7 months later, and the Commission of Inquiry into the Usindiso building fire has wrapped up what it calls the first phase of its investigation. But while authorities sift through evidence and witness testimonies, the former inhabitants of the doomed building are desperate for answers and a way forward.
So a story you've been following closely is, of course, the Usindiso building fire in Johannesburg. Recently, the first phase of the inquiry came to a close. Firstly, tell us a bit, what are some of the major revelations and testimonies that stood out for you in this first round of inquiry?
It's just revealed the deeper connections into the building and tells a story beyond the fire and the issues that existed. For me, it was actually learning that the building was actually not a residential zone, nor was that particular area, meaning that for it to be able to hold that capacity of people on a daily basis was already off, because it's not a residential area. So it's like an industrial zone. Initially, it was like a home and safe haven to abused women and children. But over time, between 2019 up until 2020, the building was ejected and more people actually found home in that building. We heard that there were like 200 sheikhs at the ground level. From the commission itself, we heard that 500 to 1,000 people are estimated to have actually resided in that building. When you think about it, everyone knew about this building. It had broken a lot of bylaws, owing electricity, owing water. They waited until the unfortunate disaster happened to actually start doing something. But it doesn't help, because they could have prevented that incident. Obviously, there's people who are still homeless. We know that about 40 families actually reside in Denver in those shacks. And then in Lindela, there's foreign brothers and sisters who live there, and they are waiting for the commission to conclude, and they'll be deported back to their home countries. Yeah.
So you've mentioned Denver, and I was going to bring that up as well, because as you've said, a lot of the victims from the fire are being housed in Denver in these tiny little shacks that look really, really unsafe. We did a story on it just recently, our story titled Shack City, where we also visited Denver to see the conditions in which these people have to live. Now, my question is, does the commission understand the urgency of finalizing the inquiry? Because many of the families simply cannot remain in these camps indefinitely.
I didn't get a sense of urgency. I didn't see it trying to urgently resolve these matters. However, I did actually send inquiries as to what's going to happen. We know of that guy who was arrested and who remains in custody. But the other people who were mentioned, are they going to follow up on the stuff that was said? For me, I don't see a sense of urgency at this point, because the commission itself has stalled for months and months on end.
So do you have any idea in terms of what happened next? Have they given any timelines in terms of when they will sit again for phase two of the commission, or is it a bit up in the air at the moment?
So this is what they told me. They said that now that phase one is done, they have until end of month to release the report on phase one. And then phase two is anticipated to resume in May, but they haven't given any particular dates.
Obviously, you can keep an eye on Daily Maverick, and Michelle will be writing about that as well. So for any coverage on the Usindiso fire, head on over to the Daily Maverick website.
It's been a long time coming, but the unbundling of Eskom is one step closer towards becoming reality. This after its transmission division was given the go-ahead. Now, government is gearing up to also separate Eskom's generation and distribution divisions. But will Eskom 2.0 be the solution the country's been waiting for?
While we were preparing for this week's episode, you told me that you're currently working on a story about Eskom's much-anticipated unbundling. Now, last week, Thursday, Public Enterprises Minister Pravin Gordhan announced that Eskom has met all the conditions necessary to establish the National Transmission Company of South Africa, or NTCSA.
So the company is separated into three entities: the generation, transmission, and distribution of electricity in the whole scheme. And it has been on the works since 2019. However, it doesn't mean that now that it's approved, everything is all systems go. There's still a lot of handovers that have to happen behind doors and processes and procedures that need to be followed in order for this to be ready to go.
So Gordhan listed a few major benefits of having an independent transmission division, including the improved business performance, a greater lender appetite because people will have more confidence in the division, we hope, and ensuring independent power providers are treated fairly. But I think the big question that most South Africans have around this is, do you see this unbundling solving our electricity woes in the long run?
It's either it would solve the electricity crisis that we currently have, but also have an impact on the cost of electricity. It's either it's going to go up or down. If there's more suppliers, obviously, it's likely to have a much more affordable price. Whereas there's less suppliers, it means the cost of electricity might slightly go up. There's a lot of questions really about how much electricity would cost. I think that's what people are also concerned about.
Just in terms of timelines, you said that, you know, it's going to take a while for everything to come into effect. But we know that government is renowned for not sticking to timelines. So I'm just wondering, is government still on track in terms of the proposed timelines that they've given, or are things already a bit on shaky ground?
So it's still kind of foggy. It's not as clear as to what is really happening, because initially, NESA said the NTCSA company would resume duties on the 1st of April. But when I inquired with Eskom, they were saying something along the lines of NTCSA has to meet a certain requirements and it has to go through another approval with NESA for it to start rolling, and that might take about 2 months. But it's still not clear. A lot of things are not clear. I'm not sure if they're even on time with their own deadlines, because already it was delayed for 4 years.
It's been 18 months since the first Fort Hare University employee was murdered, and 14 months since the former university vice chancellor's bodyguard was gunned down. Their deaths are believed to be linked to a sinister tender corruption syndicate, which operated within the hallowed halls of this once revered institution. Now, with 25 arrests to date, it seems authorities are finally getting to the very heart of this deadly network.
There's been some positive developments in the ongoing Fort Hare University murder, fraud and corruption case. Last week, Wednesday, 12 suspects appeared before the Dimbaza Magistrates Court, facing various charges including racketeering, corruption, kidnapping and murder. Now, last year, we as Carte Blanche reported on the attempted hit on then Vice Chancellor Professor Sakela Bahlungu. More than a year later, the wheels of justice are seemingly turning, very slowly that is. Have you been following this case?
I've been following it on the sidelines. My colleagues have been rigorously writing about it, and it's quite shocking that already there's like 25 suspects to date on this case.
And I think what was most surprising for me following the court proceedings is just how vast this alleged criminal network within Fort Hare was. I mean, among those arrested are the head of investigations and vetting at the university. You have Bahlungu's office manager, two Cape Town attorneys, and then, surprisingly, the late rapper, aka Keenan Forbes, former bodyguard, which is, of course, the one that everyone gravitated towards in terms of the headlines. points, but it shows you just how easily and how quickly a criminal network can really take hold of an institution. And I think that's the most worrying part for me, is just to see how easily these networks can just kind of spread their tentacles and completely break apart an institution that's respected and that has a huge cultural and historical importance within our country. Of course, a lot of our political leaders, they studied there. So yeah, it's really sad to see that it's come to this.
It is crazy and very unsettling. I mean, we already have a problem with hits and assassinations ongoing across the country in different political spheres, but now in a place of education where you'd assume people are safe and it's an environment to enable, but there's this happening. So it's really worrisome. And I hope with the case proceeding now in court, something will be done to just combat the situation, because it's really getting out of hand. It might even translate to other universities. Maybe there are things happening there that no one really knows about at the moment.
Now, you can, of course, head on over to Carte Blanche's website for our story titled Fort Hare Hit List. And then Daily Maverick journalist Estelle Ellis has put together a very useful timeline on really what went down at Fort Hare. So I encourage everyone to go and have a look at that, just to see how quickly everything just went downhill at Fort Hare.
Will they? Won't they? The Gauteng government has promised that the dreaded e-tolls will cease operation on the 11th of April at midnight. If you're rolling your eyes, we don't blame you. This is certainly not the first time we've heard such promises. But whatever happens, the e-tolls debacle serves as a reminder that the citizens of South Africa still have the power.
Onto our green shoot, and I'll be honest, I'm really struggling to say this with confidence, but Gauteng residents are finally saying goodbye to e-tolls. I want to know from you, are you confident that SANRAL will finally deliver on its long-standing promise that the gantries will finally come down?
Hopefully. I'm just hopeful because, I mean, it affects all of us drivers. I'm hopeful that finally, this is happening. I mean, it's been long coming. We've been waiting for it for years and years now. Thanks to Outer, who's also been like pushing for this to happen. We just all, you know, holding on to that hope of, we hope this is real and we hope it happens now. But I've always asked myself, okay, if they're saying goodbye to e-tolls, what happens to the outstanding debts? Are they going to be cleared as well? Or you still have to pay them off?
Yeah, so that's the big debate that's currently happening, is whether or not motorists who have outstanding e-tolls should pay those tolls. But that's just a small part of it, because firstly, of course, the date for decommissioning the dreaded e-tolls is this coming Thursday. But taxpayers really don't have much to celebrate if you think about it. And I know this is a green shoot, so stick with me. I'm going to put a positive spin on this eventually. Taxpayers really don't have much to celebrate, because ultimately National Treasury is taking over 70% of the debt owed on the e-tolls project. That includes things like maintenance and management and all of that. And then the Gauteng government takes on the remaining 30%. But, and this is why I'm confident that this is still worthy of a green shoot, is it shows that the people of this country still have the power to force government's hand, you know, if we really just stick to it and we stand together. So best to keep that in mind, I think, when you head to the polling stations in May. You know, just this is a very strong reminder that we still have the power and we can still affect change if we stick to what we believe in and if we hold those to account. So I think that's why it's a green shoot.
And it's all thanks also to like civil society. It's ordinary people like you and me who made this possible, because they're fighting behind closed doors for our tax money to be used appropriately.
No, definitely. So we're going to wait and see what happens on Thursday, if it actually does go offline and if e-tolls are indeed a thing of the past. But that is it for our show today. We've covered a lot today and it's been fascinating chatting to you. Thank you so much again for joining us, and I hope you'll be with us again soon.
Thank you for having me. I'll be back soon.
Great. That makes me very happy. And that's a wrap
Join us again next week as we unpack more local and international headlines. Until then, give Carte Blanche and Daily Maverick a like and follow on socials.